poverty, the spiritual combat that we have, and we're talking about the combat, the struggle that we have in all of us, the poverty of dispossession and dependence. The Benedictine tradition has given us what we've touched on before, we'll come to time and again. The Church's tradition until very modern times has been poverty, not only of dependence on superiors, but poverty of dispossession, that you give up. You don't just cease to own, pardon me, you don't just cease to use things independently, you cease to own in a religious community, and all religious congregations, as I think we've explained, have what is called a simple vow of poverty, which does not require the dispossession of what a person has. In the Benedictine tradition, monastic spirituality, you don't just depend, you give up. All I know is, one who belongs to an order where this is one of the conditions, it does something big to you. Once you take your last vows, you know you don't have a cent in the world, and you have vowed yourself never to own anything. Bill called me up last night. He said, "Father, I think my dad's clothes will fit you. Bring them over." So he brought them over this morning. I have just acquired 2 new coats. And I'm happy to say, this is Father Burns's cassock after he passed away. I want to tell you something. That's why I'm saying this. And may God forgive me if there's the least tinge of self-satisfaction in what I'm saying. This spiritual life is real. And once you believe it, you live it. Poverty, therefore, in the monastic tradition is dispossession, that I give up, and that I act in such a way that I don't claim ownership. And this is even in communities where you may own. There was such a thing as owning but not claiming ownership. So as I think I mentioned, and we'll talk about this when we deal with the Second Vatican Council, the Church now strongly recommends, and I'm hoping that within the next decade or so, by the new time of the code coming up, that there will be provisions in all constitutions for legislating the poverty of dispossession. Many religious communities have become too wealthy for their own good. I mean it. I would not dare identify the community. And Mother Teresa, after she had made a trip in the Midwest, and we were together the last time before she went back to India, in New York, she said, "Father, would you somehow get the message across? When I saw those beautiful grounds, such as few, even rich people, could afford, I asked myself, whom is that for? None of us wants to live in squalor. But you know, the property, for example, that some communities own, no wonder the federal government is putting more and more pressure 1,000, 1,500 acres, I know. All they've got is one mother house, that's all. And all this beautiful acreage, as far as the eye can reach, what for? That's why there was a Saint Bernard. Because by the time of Bernard, there were Benedictine monasteries that were not living up to what Benedict wanted his followers to practice. Saint Benedict simply assumed that those who entered the religious life were going to live a life of chastity. Over the centuries since Benedict, not all religious communities require virginity as a condition for admission. There are some, however, who do. In other words, we should distinguish between virginity and chastity, as is obvious, by saying that virginity is keeping one's, or having kept one's, body preserved from any carnal intercourse. For Benedict, as for the Church ever since, chastity does not mean merely the abstention from sexual experience. It is that indeed, but always motivated by the love of God and the imitation of Christ. What I wish especially to stress, because the rule of Benedict is so explicit about it, the ascetical means, which I dare say are being widely neglected. Chastity can be kept, provided one prays and practices asceticism. The two supernatural means for preserving one's chastity in the Benedictine tradition, and as I say now in the Church at large, are the Eucharist and prayer. It is impossible to live a life of chastity without frequent reception of the virginal Christ in communion. We must receive His body into our body to preserve ourselves chaste. And prayer, not only in asking for the gift, but in that humble dependence on God, which is the main purpose of prayer. Because, as I've said so many times in different ways, only humble people are chaste. Pride is always unchaste. I have yet to have that statement contradicted. And anyone who has trouble with chastity should first look to his or her humility. And the surest sign of a humble person is one who humbly, frequently has recourse to God. God, help me. The most important three syllables in the human language. But besides the supernatural means, there are the ascetical means for mortifying the body. Benedict, as you gather from his rule, and just compare it with, again, Antony, or some of the titans of asceticism that preceded Antony, he did want his followers to have adequate food and sleep, but not too much. a very important insight that Benedict had. Not to so mortify the body in, say, lack of food or sleep, as to, and you may never have heard this, but this is a good ascetical principle, lest the body seek sexual compensation. It's remarkable. Unless we are meant to mortify ourselves in body by depriving the body of food and sleep, I mean, unless we have the grace to live that kind of a mortified life, a person risks the body seeking satisfaction in other ways, because there is definite satisfaction for the body in food and sleep and drink. Who doubts it? And the body is a demanding part of our personality. What it doesn't get in one way, it's liable to demand in another way. Which reflects the balance of Benedict, you see. Don't think that if you eat less until you're starving, that you will necessarily control the sex appetite. It might be just the opposite. Makes sense, doesn't it? Given the kind of religious life that he was talking about. He suggested also the practice of modesty. Now, modesty, as we know, is the virtue of chastity in externals. The way I dress, the way I walk, the things I look at. Even speech. A garrulous tongue is a temptation to the demon of sex. Benedict was anathema to idleness. And the rule, as you know, provides every hour and every minute of every hour is somehow provided for. Also, to learn from experience that certain things that I know excite me or arouse me, maybe someone else can get away with it. I can't. And as you read Benedictine literature on the subject of chastity, you see the wise counsels that people were given, where some, for example, needed to practice either extra mortification or not be exposed to certain stimuli, where others could take them or leave them with no difficulty. So much for poverty. Something on Benedict's vision of obedience. For Benedict, although the obedience that a monk or a nun was to practice was, of course, ultimately determined by the abbot or the abbess, nevertheless, the obedience that Benedict was talking about was not only, you might say, the verbal prescriptions of rule. It is that rule interpreted by the community. Moreover, Benedict provided, as we know, for chapters at which, if you recall, he encouraged even the youngest to speak up and not to have the older ones forbid the younger ones to talk. What do they know? They may lack the experience, but they may have the Holy Spirit. In any case, this was quite different from the concept of obedience, which was almost strictly vertical, from the top down. Taken for Comius, he was, of course, the abbot of a number of monasteries and, before he died, of several thousand monks. For all practical purposes, the abbot was the rule. What he said was what everyone had to do. What Benedict did was to draw on much experience, and the rule was being constantly, as it were, reinterpreted or adapted from chapter after chapter. In fact, we now canonically speak of a chapter as that which meets only once every 4 or 6 years, right? What is it in your community, sister? 6 years?
Four, five, six years.
Whereas originally, now we have more than the vestiges of it, because a chapter is normative, isn't it? We see it as the highest legislative body in the community. But what is now only a very periodic foregathering of chosen delegates was a regular meeting of the members of a community. That's how the notion of the chapter started. Now, there was input. You notice the difference? There was input from the members, although always the abbot reserved to himself the final decision. This is the active life, and who would doubt it takes a lifetime activity? By the way, I would like to see our vocabulary gradually change in even drafting our constitutions to not so separate in other words the spiritual life as somehow divided between the contemplative and the active, as though the active were uniquely identified with the apostolate. Isn't that pretty much the popular notion nowadays? Look at your chart. How is the active life divided? Between spiritual combat and the apostolate. In other words, what has happened, and this is one reason why the religious life has run into such deep water and has run into so many problems. We've got the debris of not a few, well, I would say shiftings and changes that are not valid. To identify the active life exclusively with the apostolate is wrong, okay? As though somehow, by cutting that off and just praying and working in the apostolate, you're going to be a good religious. My dear friends in Christ, it won't work. Because you've got to struggle, right? With whom? With the world, the flesh, and ourselves. This is romanticism. This is tempting God. As I do my part, and I say my prayers, God owes it to me to take care of it. It's the business of humility. Suppose a person has not, as we've gone through such elaborate length, to describe the struggle to grow in humility. No wonder we've got in one of our provinces in 1 year, one of the smallest. We lost 6 PhDs in 1 year, the year they got their doctorate. They left the order. How convenient. You get a $50,000 education and then you leave the order. Unless a person works on, among other things, humility. God won't work miracles. And they still talk about the apostate. What kind of apostate? The apostate of self-fulfillment. All right. Let's make sure that we don't exclude from that active life that which is so primary, because we do have, God knows, and by now we know, we've got a fallen human nature with all kinds of weaknesses and stupid desires and passions that need control. So, we're still on the active life and spiritual combat. Stability as perseverance. Benedict legislated this, and this was one of his many great contributions to religious life. He saw all kind of wandering hermits, traveling, you name it, where? And as a result, they lost their spiritual vitality. I went to the trouble of finding out in the rule of Pacomius, rule 36 and rule 175, warn the monks and the nuns about traveling. Stay put. And the rule of St. Basil, rule 36, stay put. But Benedict wrote it right into the constitutions. He didn't just make a rule out of it. He made a vow out of it. Now this has, in the thousand and more years since Benedict, created all kinds of questions. But the basic idea is that a person who remains in one place perseveres in obedience to that superior. Because, as he found out, the main reason why monks and nuns want to travel, go elsewhere, is not a change of climates. Or it could be provably better for their health. They just found obedience where they were too hard. In other words, stability in Benedict's mind is a great preservative of obedience. And so religious, for example, as I have by now had so much experience transferring communities, they want to become contemplatives, cloistered contemplatives, which there are such vocations. A person in a more active community may well have a genuine vocation to a contemplative community, all quite understandable. But maybe it's not that rare occasion of having a special vocation to leave one way of life and join another community. The feeling may be, well, I may not find the demands of obedience so hard as one Trappist monk who identified himself years ago in a clerical magazine, I've never forgotten it. He left, as he said, one community to join another one. He joined a much more severe community. It was the Trappists. Less food, restrictions on diet, all kinds of limitations. But he said, take it from a man who has made the change. Give me bodily mortification, he said, any day. This is the way he put it. It's a man's way of expressing himself. It was not, he said, tightening the belt around my stomach. It is that I didn't like the tight band around my head. He left what was actually a more strict community because the obedience was more demanding. And everybody thought he was well off, a hero of virtue, because he took on himself the severe austerity of the Trappists. No, he said, it's easier. That's good to hear. In any case, for Benedict, unlike the monasticism before him, he was not hard on the body, but he sure was hard on the spirit. And for Benedict, this is centuries before Ignatius, it was obedience, obedience, that ensures a person's growth in sanctity.
This concludes the second part of Father John A. Hardin's lecture on the rise and growth of Western monasticism. The third part of this lecture will be found on the next tape.